Bet walks over to the couch on which James is sleeping. "Jay," she calls. "Someone here to see you." There's a split second when James wakes, pillow creases on his beautiful face, puffy circles under his eyes, when he's still in that hazy limbo between sleep and wakefulness. Haroon knows this place from the times they would fall asleep together in the park or in a quiet corner of a Starbucks or even on a subway when James would drift off. It would always take him a minute to emerge from sleep, to remember where he was. In that moment of in-between, Haroon can see that James still loves him. He blinks, and it's gone. And James is awake and cold. "What you doing here?"
I came to see you."
"I'll leave you to it," Colette says, touching James on the shoulder.
"I already told you, I don't want to see you again." "I'm not going to Pakistan. I'm not marrying some girl. I told my family tonight."
The words tumble out in a breathless confession. There's a flicker of interest on James's face, and his expression softens the tiniest bit. He nods. "It's a start."
"How'd that go?"
"As expected." James nods again, like he knows. Because he does.
"And I love you, and I'm sorry."
Haroon begins to cry. He takes a tentative step toward James and sinks to his knees.
"I'm so, so sorry."
At first, James stands stiff as a board, and Haroon thinks it's over for him. But then, he feels James's tentative touch on his head, hears James's soft voice say,
"It's okay." And he thinks, maybe it'll all work out.
James gently lifts Haroon to his feet and says the words he needs to hear tonight.
"I love you too."
But it sounds different than it used to. Mournful. And with a fist to the gut, Haroon knows there will be a but.
"But I can't be with you."
"Why not? I'm not marrying a girl, and I told my family, so I could be with you."
"Nah, boo. You told your family, so you could be with yourself. Live with yourself."
"I don't want to live with myself," Haroon cries. "I want to live with you, to be with you, to fly you to Fiji and Brazil and all the places."
"You're gonna have to fly there without me."
"But you just said you loved me."
"I do. But you almost walked. No coming back from that."
"There is," Haroon insists. "I'll earn your trust back." James sighs.
"You stepping out with some confection, I could handle. Some girl, even that. But you were planning to leave without a word."
"I keep thinking, if I hadn't said something in the park, would Haroon have even told me? Or would he have ghosted me? Same as my mom." And it's at the mention of his mom that Haroon understands that it's not the action. It's the deception. With James. With his family. James might love him and might even one day forgive him. But he isn't going to take him back.
"So all of this was for nothing?"
Haroon cries.
"Not for nothing,"
James says softly.
"Just not for this."
James turns away from him. But no, Haroon can't let him go, not just yet. "Wait," he calls, yanking James back. James's expression is so naked, his face so worn down by anguish. And it's seeing him like this that makes Haroon surrender. To push James any further would inflict more pain, cause more damage. It would be the act of a coward. And Haroon wants so very much to be brave. He unhooks the flash drive from his keychain and puts it in James's hands.
She'll sing at our wedding, James once promised.
This is for you, Haroon says. James stares at the drive for a moment, but he doesn't ask what it is. He just closes his hand around it, nods once more, and retreats into the hallway.
Haroon hears a door close. The click is quiet and final.
Colette comes back into the room, looking at Haroon with an almost painful compassion.
You gonna be okay, she says.
How can you know that?
Haroon asks. When a broken bone heals, it's stronger than it was before the break, she replies. Same holds true for broken hearts.
Haroon nods, prays this is true, of his own heart, of James's and Ummi's and Abu's. Colette opens the door, gestures that it's time for Haroon to leave.
Go be with your people, she tells him.
As he walks down the stairs, back into the moonlit night, he wonders, who are his people? James? Not anymore. His family? Maybe one day again. But not yet. Overhead, he hears the sound of a jet and looks up to see a 737 circling toward LaGuardia Airport. And for a brief instant, he's still the boy he once was. No secrets, only love. He blinks his eyes, and then it's Nathaniel he sees, arriving that very morning on a jet like the one above. All secrets, so little love. There's a yank on the cord around his heart, a reckoning in his bones. He flips open Nathaniel's phone. He will call his father, speak to Nathaniel, reassure him he did nothing wrong. He will help him track down Freya so they can continue to fall in love. It is the least he can do. But it's peculiar. There are no contacts in the phone, except for one. He checks the call log. There are dozens of outgoing calls, all to that one number. He dials and gets Nathaniel's father's tell-me-something-good greeting. He hangs up and tries the incoming call log, but there's just one number. He dials it and is connected to an automatic greeting for the Skagit County Medical Examiner's Office. He hangs up the phone and opens the guidebook. A slip of paper falls out. Haroon picks it up and reads. Mount Fuji, Prince Edward Viaduct, Golden Gate Bridge, George Washington Bridge, 80 miles per hour, quickest way to die. At first, he doesn't understand the meaning of Nathaniel's father's note, only that reading it rattles a knowledge that already resides in his bones, the same way his own secret has always lived in his heart. The flash of anguish that tears through him is different from the fear and uncertainty he's lived with for so long. It pushes him out of himself, and when he returns, everything has gone quiet and still, and in that moment, it all becomes clear. The vague destination near 175th Street. The father who never called back. As-salu Allah al-azim rabbil arshil azim an yashfika. The prayer comes to his lips automatically. He asks God to help Nathaniel, to help him find Nathaniel, to help him find Freya, to help all three of them heal one another. Because Nathaniel and Freya, they are his people. They are one another's people. When his phone buzzes, he knows without looking who it's from, knows that this prayer God has answered. He reads Freya's text. He tells her where Nathaniel is. And then he starts to run.
The Order of Loss, Part 12. Nathaniel. The night I found my father on the kitchen floor, I had the most powerful deja vu. At first, I thought it was because Dad was lying not far from where Grandma Mary had been lying when she'd collapsed all those years before. Later, after the paramedics came, not even trying to resuscitate Dad or pump his stomach because what was the point? After I found the hoard of pills in a shoebox under the bed, I understood that the reason seeing my father lying dead on the kitchen floor felt like it had happened before was because I'd been imagining it all my life. I'd imagined it when Mom left, and I was too young to know what I was imagining. I'd imagined it when Grandma Mary died. I'd imagined it when we buried the baby birds and the dead frog. I'd imagined it when I'd seen him weeping in the hospital after I came out of surgery. I'd imagined it every time I walked through the door after school, saw Dad on the couch, with the TV on, and exhaled a breath I'd been half-holding since I'd left that morning. I'd imagined it every time he told me, "It's just us, Nat, a fellowship of two." It was why I didn't leave. I thought if I left, for college, for Mom, for a life, I'd find my father one day on the kitchen floor. So I stayed. And in the end, I found him on that kitchen floor anyway. Deja vu. After the paramedics took Dad away, I waited for the calls to come. After Grandma Mary, that's what had happened. People came. Her church friends, my cousins, people. But the only person who called in those 2 weeks was the coroner giving me the toxicology report, which she called inconclusive. There were opioids and benzos in Dad's blood. Not huge amounts, not drug abuse amounts, or amounts that suggested this was intentional. But sometimes, the coroner explained, even small doses interact in unexpected ways. "We're listing the cause of death as accidental overdose," she told me. Inconclusive. Accidental. What did that mean? "What do you want us to do with the body?" she asked. I had no idea. When Grandma Mary died, Hector had facilitated everything. He'd called the coroner and looked up her life insurance policy and arranged it with the mortuary. I knew at the time that he was doing something my father should be doing, behaving the way a father should behave. "Just part of my job," Hector had said, though I'd recognized this as the kindest sort of lie. He'd stayed until late that night, and he'd returned the next day, even though we weren't on his rotation anymore. "I'm moving back to New York City at the end of the year," he told me, pressing his business card into my hand. "But you can call me anytime." I put my personal cell number on the back of the card. "You can always get me on that." I palmed the card, thinking he was being nice, and he was, but in retrospect I understood Hector realized I was a frog in a pot long before I did. "I don't know what to do with the body," I told the coroner. The coroner explained options, the cheapest of which was cremation. Did my father have life insurance? She wanted to know. "Was it on purpose?" I asked. Another pause. "We're listing the cause as accidental overdose," she replied. "You should still be able to collect his life insurance if he has it." That wasn't what I was asking. "Was it on purpose?" I repeated, my voice starting to break. "I need to know." "We can't divine intention, but we are listing it as an accidental overdose." "Did he do it on purpose?" The silence on the phone was terrible because it was so familiar. It was that lag between people asking you if you were okay and waiting to hear that you were fine. "Sometimes," she began falteringly, "it's better to just leave things be." "How do I do that?" "Well," she said, "you just do." She paused again. I could hear how itchy she was to get off the phone. This wasn't her job. She was not a grief counselor or a psychologist. She was a coroner calling with the good news that I could collect Dad's non-existent life insurance. She wanted me to tell her it was all good. It's what everyone wanted me to tell them. Though they must have known it wasn't all good. How could it be all good? Do you have someone you might call? She asked. Who? My mother? The last time we'd spoken was 4 years ago when I'd told her that I no longer wanted to see her. The reason I gave was not that I'd lost an eye and was afraid she'd make me lose my father, but that I didn't fit in her life and, more to the point, she didn't fit in mine. She'd cried bitterly, accusing me of always loving my father more. I didn't disagree, and I hadn't heard from her since. She didn't even know that the man with whom she had created me was gone. Who else should I call? My coach, who'd kicked me off the team? My friends, who, having procured assurances of it all being good, had wasted little time in getting the hell away? Hector, who had taken pity on me and had seen, in a way few others had, how it was with me and my father? But that was years ago. And anyway, he didn't live here anymore. And what if he did what the rest had done? Asked me, with impatience in his voice, if I was going to be okay. That I couldn't bear. And anyhow, there was only one person I wanted to call. Tell me something good, he said when I called over and over again. But I had nothing good to tell. Just us, buddy. Not just us. Just me. 10. Just us. Nathaniel has no idea where to find his father. He has no idea if Hector is right, and he'll find him in that space between life and death, where the departed appear to escort the dying. Or if they'll meet in the afterlife. If there is an afterlife. Or maybe even in the Undying Lands, one of the many impossible places his father promised they would go together. Will he know the truth in the split second that separates life from death? Will it make a difference? Will it hurt? A body coming off this bridge hits the water at 80 miles per hour. Quickest way to die, his father had written in his notes. God, he hopes so. He prays it won't hurt. He's hurt enough for one lifetime. He stands at the edge of the bridge, crying. He's crying because it's cold, and it's windy, and his head hurts, and because he's scared. He's crying because his father left him, maybe on purpose, maybe not knowing any better. And now he's staring into the inky abyss, hoping to find him there. But he sees nothing but more darkness. But mostly he's crying because in the course of one day, he's glimpsed the life he never had. The life he would have liked to have. The life he can't have because of the life he did have. He doesn't want to die. This was never about wanting to die. But he can't be alone anymore. He's been alone for too long. Not just those unbearable 2 weeks, but the years before. He and his dad in the house in the woods, just us. Their fellowship of two has rendered him incapable of living amid the rest of the world. Today proves that. Haroon's face proves that. Even Freya's kiss proves that. It's not never having things that hurt. It's having them and not having them at the same time. It's having a best friend for a father, and having a lunatic for a father. It's having a mother who loves you, and having a mother who deserts you. It's having always known people like Freya and Tarun were out there, but being unable to reach them. Dad, are you here? He shouts into the empty night. Can you see me? There's no answer save for the rumble of traffic below, and beyond that, the sound of a river, still wild, even here. In his hand he holds all he has left, his father's copy of the Lord of the Rings. When his father had declared them a fellowship of two, he felt anointed, a holy mission. He was 7 years old, too young to know that there's no such thing as a fellowship of two. A fellowship is a group, an army, a mass. Two people aren't enough. Two people can't save each other. How many times did he hear stories about one person drowning and the other person trying to help, but they drag each other down? It happens all the time. Nathaniel screams to the void as he claws at the pages of the book. The binding's so old and creased and the glue is weak, but the book refuses to give. He manages to tear only a small handful of pages from the spine. The pain feels like it is cleaving him in two. What is so wrong with him? What has rendered him so unlovable, so invisible? "Dad, do you see me?" he screams. "Do you see what you did to me? Why?" In the silence that follows, Nathaniel understands he's asking the wrong person the wrong question. It's not why his father did this to him. It's why everyone else stood by and let him. His father didn't know any better. But what about everyone else? Why didn't anyone turn off the stove? Gently lift him from the pot and lay him on the soft, leafy ground before it was too late. Nathaniel grips the book, the seed of their sick fellowship, and with every ounce of will left in him, he hurls it. In the light of the moon, he watches the pages flutter as the book sails higher in the air than the physical laws of the universe dictate it should, and descends not at a painful 80 miles per hour, but gently, slowly, as if gravity has, for this one moment, reversed itself, allowing Nathaniel to back up and imagine his life with a different kind of fellowship. In this version, Nathaniel plays softball once a week on a grubby patch of grass with people who already know his name. In this version, Nathaniel is seated at a large dining table, not eating buttered noodles with one other person, but sitting with whole groups of people, eating foods whose names he does not yet know, but whose flavors he has always known. In this version, Nathaniel is not leaping to his own death, but gently escorting others when it's their time, as Hector had done with Mary, helping them say the things they need to say while there's still breath, helping those left behind grapple with the questions he knows are sometimes unanswerable. In this version, he's kissing a girl whose voice he can hear even when she's not singing. In this version, Nathaniel is not alone. Because today, Nathaniel was not alone. None of them were. Not after they found each other. He's too far up to hear the book splash, but he knows the instant it makes contact with the water, because at that moment a sob escapes from the deepest part of him, and when it does, 1,000 pounds of sorrow, more than a lifetime of it, flow out of him. Was this how Frodo felt when Gollum finally fell into Mount Doom, destroying the ring, relieving him once and for all of the beautiful, terrible burden? Nathaniel steps away from the railing. He won't see his father tonight. He might never see his father again. Might never know why he left their fellowship of two, or why he created it in the first place. Maybe his father didn't know that a fellowship of two is too small. You need more people. Mothers who you will forgive and who will forgive you back. Wise hospice nurses who will teach you to escort people to the undying lands. Teammates who won't care if you can only see with one eye, because they'll know that the trick to a good catch is seeing the ball in your mind's eye. You need people who will give you the food from their plate because they feel your hunger, who will refuse to let you wander off alone no matter how many times you say it's all good, who will snap in your face and whisper so softly in your ear, Nathaniel, come back. Come back. Until you do. Nathaniel. Nathaniel. He hears her voice. Even with his eyes closed, he would know that voice. He's been hearing it since that day in the forest. Nathaniel. Nathaniel. He opens his eyes and sees Freya and Tarun running toward him. Nathaniel. Nathaniel. If that's not singing, Nathaniel doesn't know what is. Nathaniel. Nathaniel. They see him. He hears them. They find each other.
You must confess, I'm a white-hot mess, and I need you here. I need you near to quench my fear. And all that I said I wanted was a little white dress. And all that I said I needed was a little white dress. Did the thing I said I would. Let music do what words never could. You're a thorn in my side, but loving you is how I survive. And all that I said I wanted was a little white dress. And all that I said I wanted was a little white dress. So, do you remember we used to sing Eshiruru, Eshiruru, Eshiruru. Hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye, hush-a-bye. And all that I said I wanted was a little white dress. And all that I said I needed was a little white dress. And though I obsess about being a black star mess, I'd rather have that than a bloody white dress. Eshiruru, Eshiruru.
This is Nicole Lewis. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I Have Lost My Way by Gail Forman. This program was directed by Olivia Mackenzie Smith. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by Gail Forman. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. Music copyright, Gail Forman and Libba Bray. Piano and synths by Bill Zeffiro. Vocals by Sasha Abner. Backing vocals by Libba Bray. Recorded and engineered by Chip M. Fabrizi at PPI Recording. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.